We are lying on Robert Frost's lawn. We cup our hands around clumps of grass to hold on to what's left of the afternoon. We listen to the hermit thrushes and strain to hear the stream over their song. To do this, we must not speak, and anyway we can't, because then everyone would know what they are not supposed to know and what we ourselves do not even know for sure. They would hear it in the pauses, too luxurious for mere friends. We have divorced technology and shunned reality. We are thinking backward in iambic pentameter by threes. Do not call home if at all possible, we were told at orientation. No one will understand. John Elder stands in front of us. He begins a lecture on Frost, Vermont, frost trees, which surround us on all sides. It's an incantation for the dead at this close range. Like many of Frost's poems, Elder's lecture draws us into the landscape but doesn't tell us what to make of it. Beyond Elder is a cabin, one of two of Frost's former homes. The lecture is part of the program, propping up our minds with speeches, dangling Frost's house in front of us like candy. We're not sure what's edible and what isn't. We stuff gray pebbles into our fleshy cheeks like gobstoppers, tip sunshiny daffodils to our mouths, pinkies up. Elder quotes a Frost poem about a thrush woodbird and a tree as we listen and look, the very bird, the very tree. It is too much, too sacred, and on an acid trip of words, we draw nearer one another on the lawn in shrinking orbits, pairing off or grouping together in threes. Our real lives shift beneath us. I almost believe I am one of them, the learned and graduate-programmed people on the lawn. I was not accepted the way they were, green-lighted by committee. I was waitlisted and sit on this lawn only because someone dropped out last minute. Everyone knows it, especially me. It is possible that in this world, people have mothers who read them Baudelaire at bedtime as children and fathers who quoted Keats during family meals made from scratch. It is possible for me to pretend that I belong here or share their history. There is one thing we have in common. We are tired of explaining ourselves with words. Elder limits his talk to our immediate surroundings. He says nothing of the state's curated legacy beyond these trees. Intoxicating beauty is everywhere in Vermont. It is designed to have an effect on visitors. It will send you into a rapturous stupor like the over-oxygenated casinos of Las Vegas that make you forget what sleep is. But Vermont is more complex than this lawn, these trees. In the late 1800s, a collapsed agricultural economy resulted in a talent exodus. In the 1920s, the state countered this problem with two remedies. First, Vermont's beauty would be systematically preserved in hopes of promoting a wealthy tourist culture that would create an influx of prosperity. Second, voluntary eugenics policies aimed at curbing the reproductive capacity of the state's so-called degenerates, their word, not mine, would arrest growth of the wrong kind of public. This knowledge makes it hard to isolate my thoughts locally, to bind them within this tree line. At this diversely populated conference, Vermont's overwhelmingly white population is suddenly very apparent. On this lawn, I am ancient and newborn at once. The whole world pulses in my wrist. I watch my new friend's face grow more familiar by the hour. Soon, I have loved him for 5 years at least. I know the structure of his sentences. He favors semicolons, em-dashes, and parenthetical asides. I know how he likes his coffee and when, black, mornings, into the afternoons. I know that when he looks for me across the lawn, scanning the faces of poets, his bottom lip will collapse a little when he doesn't see me. I won't be there. I won't be waiting for him. I'll be far from the Peloton, scraping the bark of an oak with my fingernail. His face is a map of the fields he ran through as a child, gently creased from too much thinking. Or maybe he is worried about this growing thing between us that won't stay in my pocket no matter how I fold it up to size. Let us say it is the fields. I too ran in those fields. I see them still when I sleep. I'll tell him now. It's a farce. There is nothing in my pocket. My mother did not read Baudelaire at my bedside. She did not read at all, although she could. She sang Carly Simon in the dark. In my retelling of my mother, I fiction her a glowing cigarette at night and a father, too, for she did not smoke or have a father either. She had four fathers and also none. It is complicated. I didn't come from long lines of educators or artists or philosophers like my friend did, but I came from water, from fields, from a fabled land between those. It is quiet here in the mountains. I believe I fear actual science. Silence. The far edge of quietude. In Annie Dillard's essay, Total Eclipse, she describes leaving the site in an eclipse, viewing before it is over because the experience is too all-consuming. She plunges into a meditation on existence, barely emerging before the eclipse's shadow sweeps her under and away for good. It is now that the temptation is strongest to leave these regions. We have seen enough. Let's go. Silence strikes me as a kind of total eclipse, and this lawn of frost may be just as risky. It could overtake me. Pure silence, pure freedom would somehow reveal me to myself too starkly, too soon. The lighting would be wrong, the picture unsettling, distorted further than I expected in every direction. I want only to see a little bit more at a time, to mine carefully through the layers of sediment below my feet, to lose water by drops and not by gushes, to fly and return. I want some sense of clarity about the buried alluvial beds, to hold as precious goods the names of its materials, to walk across them and experience the malleability of the middle. Vermont's degenerates were identified by the state's foremost eugenicist, Professor Henry Perkins, who later became the president of the American Eugenics Society. For 3 years, and at the same time that the Frost School was established, Perkins would help identify degenerates in the state unscientifically, taking people's reputations within their communities as proof. Among them were the poor, the mentally disabled, the incarcerated, the people of Abenaki and French Canadian descent. He charted individual families' mental failings and misfortunes on circular charts, modified from the kind used in documenting animal pedigree. He notched and lined segments of immorality, crime, and incompetence propagated through sexual reproduction. Perkins kept an incriminating file of English corruptions of French names to root them out. Lo, the strength of words in the hands of a man with power. Whoever we were before does not matter so much here. We bow to green knolls here. We are mountain high. We find ourselves ankle deep in streams, lost in make-believe and choking on milkweed. We look into corners for the light from which we'll craft a day or the next line. But even as we frolic, we write ourselves backward in time. My friend revisits headlines about the collapsing coal industry from his journalism days in the Rust Belt. I dredge my riverbed for silt, looking at maps that show how the water and land have changed, and write fiction about a boy and girl who grew up side by side along a riverbank that is barely fiction. We pick at our respective terrains for something usable, gathering retrospective meaning where there once was none. Headlines offer little reason, I suggest to my friend. They reek of a senseless world. But I still know the black shape of smoke, I tell him, and how it huddles over a small town, how it can follow you anywhere if you believe in symbolism. I left the Midwest, and I could leave my whole life, too, if only he'd ask. But if I check his pocket for the question, I won't find it. We don't live that bravely. There was a group of people who were neither Vermont's degenerates nor its ideal. Via eugenic duality, Perkins noted, there existed in some lineages both social individuals, those apparently law-abiding, self-supporting, and doing some useful work, and asocial individuals, those who displayed the familiar repertoire of pathology. My family would have fallen here, neither the elite nor the useless, but I fear that Perkins was alluding to class and race. Frost, the man, Robert, Bob, he wasn't on Perkins' list. He was white and educated, privileged and productive. He was less gentle than this land, but then the land is a liar and keeps our secrets. I have buried mine in its soil. I have screamed into gathering storms. I have set things on fire, bits of paper, photographs. Frost was flawed like all of us and a fire starter too, they say. I find that unimpressive. Most anything can burn. Most anything contradicts. The Frost homes are empty. They have been for years. They keep their secrets, too. The small cabin burned up once, some townie kids with nothing to do. It was empty, so were they, so it goes. And once the bigger house was ravaged by drunken teens, they hawked their bodily fluids onto its aging surfaces and used its furniture for fire. If you could open the chests of these youth for inspection one by one and distend their individual charts of misfortune, they, too, would reveal a study in contradictions. They were the children of doctors and professors. Because of that, I would bet these kids got off easy, which makes me wonder about Corey. If he had been the child of the upper middle class Dutch parents, would he have ended up in prison? Those early arrests for marijuana, joyriding, petty theft very likely would have ended up in a police escort home and a stern warning. Being born on the other side of the river, staying out of the juvenile detention center might have made a difference. A line of ants pile grains of dirt near my friend's shoulder. Do you know, I say, that each ant in a colony is tasked with a role from birth, and none are expendable? Each is crucial to the survival of the colony. Even those that die of stupidity are carried home and buried. The picnic beyond us is being carried away that we have not eaten. The staff watches us and waits for us to want hamburgers. They think we have chosen this life, but it has chosen us, and we are tired of explaining ourselves. The world is made of bent shapes from this view on our backs, which is the position designed for telling lies about who we are beyond Robert Frost's lawn. I decide my friend doesn't have a mother, and John Elder may have two. My friend is a classic oil portrait, and I am a watercolor picture. We could be happy here together, drying out in the sun. It's hard not to be a poet when you're sitting on Frost's lawn, especially when you are one. Together we look for a line, a stanza, a downbeat between the maple trees and the wood near the lawn, because we can't help it, and it's either that or suck the sap from the cut rings, still raw from last season's tapping. We are that thirsty. But the trees are not poems, never have been, do not contain poems, never have contained them. They have nothing to say about who we are. They have nothing to say about integrity or rationality or depression or the books our mothers never read. They have nothing to say about what to do next with a life. Don't look into the woods for an answer. The word tree is invented. We tell them what they are, not the other way around. Eugenics was publicly promoted in rural areas of the state through fittest family tests at county fairs. The tests were propagandized as evidence that some families could not match up to Vermont's ideal standard of mental and physical faculties, by which they apparently meant lineage, class, and race. I wonder about the ancestry of the teens who damaged the Frost properties, whether any of their aunts or uncles had been sterilized, and how their destructive nature had slipped through. What with all that precaution? Maybe they'd been waitlisted too, or maybe they'd just been wealthy enough for it not to matter. When the lecture ends, no one can stand. Our knees are gummy, our skulls have cracked open, my brain is hemorrhaging, the acid trip has gone wonky. Make a tree again. Make a bird, a bird. We wait for the right words to say, to write, to omit. To be grasshoppers would be better. Grasshoppers are not asked to explain or decide or grow up or let go or make meaning of the world around them, to control themselves or conform. There are some hard rules to this suspended world: gravity, velocity, thermodynamics, genetic expression. Others are forgettable: promises, contracts, leases, vows. Entire histories came before this mountain, but they seem distant now. My husband, for example, and no one is talking about him. My friend's girlfriend, whose name I've never heard him speak. Real people have been reduced to pronouns, so sewers, semiotics run amok. My friend tells me he has three cats, and in another life, I could love him for that fact alone. This grass has always been here. Before it was called grass, it was here. It will be here when we leave. We are more mutable than it. Before he begins the guided nature walk, Elder invites us to tour the cabin. It is open. It is empty. Go ahead. The staff roll the last of the picnic away and give us their final fretful glances. Don't worry, I think. We belong to other practical people who keep us from starving in our regular lives. Let us have our hunger here until night. When the sky is black, we can split the stars and gather the sparks to build a fire. Let's go inside, I say, once we're alone. We shouldn't, he says, but we do, and I like how easily he bends for me. Degenerate is also a verb. I could build a fire inside, and we could sit in front of it, holding hands, as if it were ours, as if we do it all the time, as if our imaginary children might return from playing outside at any moment, as if a pie were cooling on the counter, as if his cats could come any minute now to lie in our laps for an afternoon nap. Let me do something, I could say. Let me touch your collarbone. I will get away with eccentricity. It will be expected. My moral backslides will be considered artistic, my degenerate nature interesting. His collarbone will be smooth and firm, so different from the one that I am used to touching that I will cry. The surprise of him will be too much, the thing signified severed from the signifier, twice removed from bone. He'll reach for me once I've had my fill of semiotics and gathered my hair in his fist. Go ahead, smell it, I'll say, tipping my head to his chest. He'll bend his head over mine and inhale. He'll snuff me out this way for what I really am, an imposter who languished all day on Robert Frost's lawn undetected. This will somehow be more intimate than fucking. We could do the easiest thing, undress, but we won't. We'll stand there in Frost's house holding these strange parts of one another as long as we want. We'll be adorned in a particular sadness, consumed by the ghosts that rise from the lawn, by the trees that stalk one another into the distance, each forever gaining on the next, by the children who burned this house and trashed the other, by the children who were never born to their degenerate families. We'll remember our separate pasts, whatever they are. We'll fill in the stories we were never told as we drifted off to sleep. We will cast off the illusion of language and all the things we think we have to do. We will seek instead the secrets of the land, the parts we tell and retell, the histories omitted, the erasure. We will seek what hangs on after the fog lifts. Elder never comes back from the woods, and we are the last ones to leave. We walk for a mile, our eyes fixed on the sky to keep it from falling down. A black cloud follows us. It signifies nothing but rain. For the first time, I feel no inclination to be as loud as the incoming storm. I can expand into the silence without fear of eclipse. The path below our feet is only a piece of earth that has been walked on by other feet. It needs no name, only use. The forest can keep its trees. The birds can keep their song. Thank you. Yeah.